You're listening to Panel Borders. I'm Alex Fitch, and this is the second of two double-length episodes in which Duncan Knott and myself are talking to comics gossip columnist and graphic novelist Rich Johnson. In the second half of the interview, we're talking about censorship, legal action, and cause célèbre in comic books.
Well, I mean, I discussed with a friend of yours, Patty Jerez, in Bristol, the whole sort of nature of homoeroticism of comics in general. But the story you're talking about, the painting of Captain Steel by Alex Ross,
the one, yes.
Where the size of the bulge in his groin was reduced. I mean, do you think, as in sort of Hollywood movies, which are now sort of seen as a major sort of have a major relationship with comics because of all the sort of Marvel films and, you know, the resurrection of Superman and Batman, the same kind of heterosexual fear of, you know, any kind of like gay targeting applies to comics as well, and that's why that became such an issue, even though comics are intrinsically homoerotic?
I think so. I mean, the first real example of that I remember was from the first Batman movie from Tim Burton, and at the same time the Arkham Asylum graphic novel came out, and it originally had, I think, the Joker dressed up as Madonna in there, and apparently some executive said, but no, if you publish that, then people will think that Jack Nicholson is gay. And that was in some way a conclusion that was drawn. So, but you are seeing that now. It's very much, companies are much more protective, even more than they ever were, of their main icons, because they're being exploited by Hollywood, and you don't want to do anything to mess with them. There's some examples where certain treatments of characters. I think Nick Fury was in a book by Garth Ennis and Derek Robertson for Marvel, was picked up by people who were going to have George Clooney playing him in the movie version, and their people read the book, and it was a hate-filled, very very funny, but very very kind of like old dinosaur Cold War story, and it was racist to make a point, kind of stuff. It was using certain like Cold War archetypes of how the American used to see the world, and it was being very funny in the process, and George Clooney's people saw that and said, George Clooney's not going to be Nick Fury, we've just read this comic book of yours. At that moment at Marvel, that was a massive sledgehammer came back, and so many treatments of their characters were suddenly withdrawn because of the fear that any second now one single comic could bring down Spider-Man 3 and the millions and billions that could have been made. So yes, I think the fear is there, and it has actually been justified. The Nick Fury movie didn't happen because of a small comic book with a very small print run.
That seems entirely absurd, though. If comics
Hollywood
in the top 10, you know, sell like 150,000 copies and millions of people go to see a movie, surely, other than using the comic to like nick ideas from to make a movie from, there's very other little relationship, unfortunately.
Oh, well, it's not true, because although it may only have, say, I don't know, print run of 30,000, some journalists will have it. And so the moment you have, they'll be able to draw images, you can actually damage actors' careers, possibly. That's the way journalism works these days. It's so easy to just take two little aspects, draw them together, make a conclusion, and it can have all sorts of effects. I should know. But
Is that why you said in your column recently you're loath to be called a journalist?
Well, it's an easy get out, because if you're a journalist, then you have to have certain responsibilities, and you have to, you know, have to get extra sourcing, and you have to name your sources, and none of my sources want to be named, and you also have to be, it seems you have to be a bit more serious, and I think it's much more fun just being a fun, entertaining gossip columnist who can shine a spotlight onto all sorts of parts of the industry. In fact, someone, a creator, did actually have a go at me lately. He said, while I did a wonderful job at like bringing to light how people were not getting paid by certain publishers and how this is important, but then why do you have to do all this other gossipy stuff? Kind of stuff? And my point was, well, you know, people don't actually come to my column to find out what publisher is not paying what creator. I think that's a side benefit. They come to my column to find out who's about to die, or what new comic's coming out, or which creator has refused to work with another creator, which feud is going on between which publisher and which creator. And that's why they come, and they get, and I kind of feed them all the industry information they probably need to know as well there. So if I'd just been doing a who isn't paying who, I think it would be a column with very few readers. Possibly only the people actually featured in the stories would be reading it.
I was just thinking back to the thought you were having before about how the big publishers sometimes clamping down to protect their properties. I suppose in a way kudos has to go to DC for letting The Boys, another Garth Ennis effort, carry on with everything just subtly disguised over at, is it Dynamic? because reading that in a way seemed to be quite a breath of fresh air, in the sense it was just going so far against what we've maybe been used to over the last few years, in terms of, no, here's a few taboos, let's just run straight through out the other side and carry on into the distance.
It's down to some people at the top of DC, their fear of their superhero brands being damaged. I mean, the boys' book, it's creator-owned, so they couldn't have actually stopped it going in the long run anyway. It's a creator-owned book. But it did have certain familiar superhero archetypes in all sorts of disgusting and terrible fashions. But this is a book that had been approved by DC. Everything in there had actually been approved. It had gone to print, and it had there was no more extreme stuff in there than there was much more extreme stuff in, say, Garth's previous works and like Preacher, than in The Boys.
It's but not with obvious superhero archetypes. No.
Indeed, but it just seems such a petty, strange thing. And this poor Wildstorm, they put this book out at an imprint of DC. They'd been boulderized before. They had their knees cut off them from so many other projects. The Boys was a genuine success. Every issue was going up in sales. It was doing very, very well. And then the big boss said, "This successful comic book we're publishing, I don't like the way it might look like it's possibly showing someone who looks a bit like Superman. So as a result, we're going to cancel it." And I can't see they've got much benefit out of it. I don't think people see the Superman movies or the character any differently. And the book is still being published, just from a different publisher. So that it's not like they've stopped it from appearing. It's still out there. They're still using the strange Superman archetype. In fact, it seems to be selling very well. Possibly now selling more. And then there's a lot more attention drawn towards it as well. So it's backfired, if anything.
I didn't realise it was creator-owned, so that makes it easier to transfer from one to the other, obviously. But I mean, just the fact that it was there at all, I thought, you know, was at least a sign that, you know, there was some life in the wider world. Yeah.
No, I agree. When it came out, you think, oh, that's fantastic. Maybe DC have changed. Wonderful. Yeah. And then a few issues later, you go, oh, no, they're just the same as they are. Now they've cancelled the book. It's just so disheartening to see that, especially for the Wildstorm imprints, who seem to go through so many different trials and tribulations to put out books that sell. And then when they do, they're going to get chopped off at the knees. But no, I don't really have that much credit for DC for that. I mean, to be honest, I think most of the reason why they let the book go as easily as they did, even though it was creator-owned, was because they liked the creators. I mean, Garth Ennis and Derek Robertson was an exclusive DC creator as well. So almost to keep everything sweet, I think. But all it means is what's happened is now the book still exists. It probably sells more. And the only difference is that DC aren't getting the benefit of it.
If Wildstorm hadn't given it the go, maybe Wildstorm get the credit here, would it have taken off in quite the same way if it had gone straight to a much smaller publisher, where maybe there wouldn't have been the sort of the instant obvious link to Superman and the Justice League and things like that?
No, I certainly don't think it would have done as well. And I think the current publisher is benefiting from the fact that DC did initially publish it. But it just seems such a strange thing, you know, to know what this book is, publish the book, and then suddenly when it's out there going, what is this book that we have just published? No one told us we were publishing this book. And it just seems to be the left hand and the right hand, since you're not knowing what the other's doing. It just seems smacks of incompetency to me. And an annoyance, because, you know, for 2 months I couldn't get this comic book. You know, the delay while they were going from publisher to publisher. But it all works. I mean, it's such a small thing in the long run of things. But it does sometimes seem a bit of an indicative of... So, I mean, it's not just DC. I mean, Marvel have been through similar situations themselves, where they've had to pull characters or pull stories just the way they may have actually gone off in a way that they've been approved. And then when it actually happens, suddenly people change their minds. The Diana issues of Ecstatics come to mind, where they had a zombie mutant Princess Diana come from the grave to join the superhero team. And this was great. And
then
the news hit the Daily Mail. I might have had something to do with that. But and then apparently, and this is how the story goes, Elton John read this somewhere. He got so upset by that, he called his best mate Avi Arad at the Marvel Studios and said, "What's all this going on?" And then that gets back to Marvel, and the book has to come off the shelves and be totally rechanged. Because, I mean, again, you never know. Publicity, you never know what's going to happen sometimes. And so the books did come out, but just with a very different changed character, and it didn't really work as well. And it kind of like, it hurt the book, because if that book had gone to press with the publicity it had, it would have done very well indeed.
You get the thought, and you have to sympathise for the editor who's sitting there going, right, well, we've got this, might be a bit risque, but what could possibly go wrong? What, you're like, what could possibly go wrong, Elton John? Yes. Yeah,
it's
definitely.
It's like Swamp Thing meeting Jesus.
Yes, oh, yes, again, there's another classic one before my reporting time, but yes, the Swamp Thing meets Jesus episode, which was suddenly pulled and all those creators boycotting DC and things. Yeah, I mean, again, something that was approved and then suddenly before publication, suddenly unapproved. I mean, that's, I think, what annoys critics more than anything. If it's like nixed at the initial stages of pitching or whatever, they say, no, we can't do that, that's you can't do that. But once you actually get approval and it's created and then you suddenly pull the rug from under their feet, I can see why they get so annoyed and why they come to me, which is great. So I should have more, actually. I should have more time so I can write better columns.
I mean, presumably while you've been doing the column, you've seen sort of waxing and waning of liberalism in sort of the exec positions at DC and Marvel. Because using the boys as an example, that would suggest then if the authority started from scratch now, they wouldn't be particularly keen on the idea of having a gay Batman and gay Superman leading the team.
The authority was one of the stories I really kind of cut my teeth on. Again, the changing artwork and the changing stories that suddenly were mandated from above. Yes, I got an awful lot of mileage out of all the changes they put on the authority. I mean, weirdly, I mean, these books now are coming out elsewhere. We just had Warren Ellis's Black Summer coming out from Avatar, which is probably him doing authorityng the authority even more. It starts off with one of the lead superheroes killing the President of the United States and then announcing it to the press corps. And then you have having an incredibly insanely violent superhero comic coming out of that. And that very much seems to be Warren's, if I was doing the authority and I really want to do the authority, this is what I'd be doing. But you can never see DC Comics publishing that. And even with Marvel, with their Max line, it would be quite difficult.
One of the topics that you must be tempted to cover in your column is the ridiculous nature of the media attention to like the big publishers. Because if you look at the top 10 comics that sell in their tens of thousands, and then just looking at publishing in this country, for example, where Doctor Who Adventures sells 150,000 copies, why aren't there conventions devoted to Doctor Who Adventures? I mean, you know, it just seems really ridiculously skewed.
Indeed. Well, it kind of gets to do with the age of the audience. Mm. If it's 8-year-olds buying these comics, they're not going to go to a convention. They're not going to have the money to spend. No, you need to have the people actually spending the money, people in their 20s and 30s and 40s, or older with large amounts of money who are quite happy to go to a convention and spend it. And that's where these kind of conventions aim themselves towards. And I think rightly so, they're there to exist financially. And if you had a bunch of 8-year-olds with their 25 pence pocket money, might be a little bit more these days, but even so, it's not going to be enough to merit putting on such a show. I mean, the big one is something like Viz. I mean, Viz still sells like 150,000 every issue, and that's a fantastically successful thing. But you know, again, it's by people who wouldn't actually go anywhere specifically to meet the Viz creators. They probably don't even realise the Viz creators exist. They're just kind of like art robots somewhere. You need a very much kind of like committed audience who buy things. It's very much part of their lives. I mean, most people buy Viz. It's not part of their life, but most people who buy the authority, yes, it's quite a big part of their life. And so that's why the conventions, I think, can appeal to them very well.
But I mean, looking at the figures that the top 10 suggests, you know, as in these are the best-selling comics, I mean, it obviously edits out all sorts of other ways of publishing comics. Because I remember reading an article recently that the Disney Adventures comic had been cancelled in America because it was now only selling 2 million copies. You know, surely that should be the number one, you know, far above World War Hulk or whatever.
Yeah, it depends where you measure it. I mean, the top 10 of comics sold through Diamond Comics to direct market stores in the USA. If that's
bought
the chart. Bought by 35-year-old geeks. Yes, I mean, if that is your that's your chart, then that's a valid chart. And it's not, there are other charts available, but those are the ones that the comics industry obsesses about and tries not to look too hard at the manga sales in bookstores, where Naruto will sell however million it will this week. The bookstores is something that clearly the big publishers are starting to take a lot more attention to. I mean, the huge outpouring of trade paperbacks now takes advantage of the bookstore industry so much. So yes, and charts will change to reflect that. But often charts are actually quite commercially sensitive information, and while the direct market has its chart, certain other markets don't have those yet, and they will be developed once they have value, once the publisher believes they have value to the consumer. Because if they're not, then they won't exist.
From your experience, we talk about the trade paperback sales. How dependent are the paperbacks on the sales of the original issues, do you think? I mean, because I know I'm one of these people who goes, that looks great, but I'd rather wait for the book. And then there's this little voice in the back of my head that says, am I all right waiting for the book? If I don't buy it now, will the book ever appear? I mean, do you have a feel for how, you know, which one's the cart and which one's the horse at the moment?
It's definitely a symbiotic relationship. Basically, the publishing of the individual issues pays for the art and the writing to be created. That's how you pay the creators initially, through the money or what a lack of it that you get from the initial issues. And anything that's lacking in that will be made up with the trade paperback issues. And they will hope, use the trade paperbacks to continue selling in the years and years ahead. You do get this strange Catch-22 situation. The strange Catch-22 situation where you have... we will only... collect these issues as a trade paperback if they sell well enough to merit a trade paperback. But of course, if they don't, then we won't have a trade paperback. So you can't wait to get it, otherwise you're not going to get it. And I just want to buy the nice collections of them. But there are some books that I realise actually probably won't get collected, or there's much less chance. I mean, it's much easier for a book to be collected now. It's much more part of the publishing model. You look at things like Vertigo; they seem to make. That is their model. You do a few issues, you put a book out, and then you hopefully keep it going long enough. But you've seen some great series that have been cancelled due to poor sales of the issues, to which the trade paperbacks have been perfectly fine, but they just haven't had enough money initially to keep justifying it going. And there's some I look at now. One of my favourites right now from Vertigo is Army at Love by Rick Veitch and Gary Erskine, and I'm buying that in single issues because it really does appeal to me, and I just want to know what's happening on a month-to-month basis. But also got that feeling that I don't know if this is going to make it to a trade paperback, so I just want to enjoy it while I've got it. But there's the other thing, of course, if it does get cancelled because too few people bought it as single issues, you can just go back and buy those single issues probably pretty cheap because no one bought it. So although it may suddenly cut out by issue 8, at least, you know, you didn't pay too much and you got a little bit of your story. But I mean, that has happened. One of my favourite stories, Outlaw Nation from Vertigo, that suffered. It was going to be one of these massive, long stories, and it was cut at about issue 20, I think, because of that exact reason, that just the sales weren't there, because everyone was waiting for the trade. So there is going to have to be a way to fix this. And DC are probably doing very well at this. It's probably one of their strongest success is maintaining their trade paperback library and turning books that were not initial successes into successes. Things like Why the Last Man, that's a booming book for DC, but it wasn't always. And again, Preacher, we look at Preacher now, we think fantastic, it wasn't always. Sandman, there we are, the big granddaddy of Vertigo, did not do very well initially. They had to do all sorts of like PR stunts about two-thirds of the year in order to try and just get a few more people to buy issues. And now, no, you look back and you can't think that anyone would have thought Sandman wouldn't sell well, but it in terms of its other competitors at the time, it didn't. So you never know what, if you cancel a series, you never know what you could have had. And that's something that DC do deal with. And they're doing it very well. I mean, they put into trade paperbacks books which probably don't commercially justify it on the hope that it will turn itself around. And sometimes it does and sometimes it doesn't.
Thinking about the sort of the ongoing income stream from the trade paperbacks, but also in the potential to, as with The Boys, move from one company to another, is this perhaps going to feel another push towards creator rights, creator ownership, or some way which first gets creators a stake in that longer term sales proposition, but also if it doesn't turn out well on the individual issues, maybe you could take it to another slightly smaller publisher and keep the fans happy as well that way, and maybe, you know, if there was the bigger publishers willing to sort of concede a bit more of a stake and actually keep two of their constituencies a bit happier in the long run.
I mean, it does happen. I mean, it's rare, but it does happen. The Boys, it happened. Peter David took Fallen Angel to IDW. Again, I think 2020 Visions, that move to Cybrosia. It does happen, but it's rare. It is legally difficult. You need to have a goodwill from all sides, and sometimes that doesn't happen. It can happen, but it's tricky. And yes, I'm sure some people would like to have that clause built into their contracts, and that may well be. But then, of course, it might make it just easier for your creators, once you make a big success, to take the book elsewhere. So, and not I don't think publishers really agree to. If this book succeeds, then you may take it to another publisher. That I can't see them buying into that. And again, this is something from DC, which has strong creator-owned properties. Plus, something like Marvel has hardly anything. They give a couple of creator-owned books to some of their more successful creators who are doing things like Spider-Man and X-Men for them. So DC certainly leagues ahead for Marvel in this area. But they look at books like Image. Quite a few people are finding that Image is working as a very strong model for a successful, you know, A-list creator to put books out that they own and can make an awful lot of money on. The Image deal, if you can sell 15,000-20,000 issues through Image, you will make more money through Image than if you sell 60,000-70,000 through Marvel. It's a huge difference, and that's another appeal. And you see all sorts of like mini Images setting up around the comics industry as well, who are offering various different rights and allowing people to own their work and giving them the vast share of the money that comes in. Again, they're not some of them do better than others. There's certainly an awful lot of opportunity out there. There's a lot of publishers, a lot of opportunity. If you've got the content, if you've got the stuff there, I mean, if your stuff's not that good, then it doesn't really matter where you're going to take it.
And then I suppose the opposite end of the scale of successful stories of creators moving their stuff elsewhere is something like the Neil Gaiman, Todd McFarlane, Miracle Man fiasco that looks like it's never ever going to end.
Yeah, there are so many different contracts out there, and who had what right reverted, and how much does Gary Leach own, how much does their skin own, and who transferred theirs, and did anybody own any of it in the first place, and is it all owned by Mick Anglo anyway? And I've been following this story now since the column began 14 years ago, and it's nowhere even close to being resolved. It's a great superhero story. It's one of the great ones. Alan Moore, Alan Davis, Gary Leach, John Tottleburn, Rick Veitch, Steve Bissett, Neil Gaiman, Mark Buckingham. Great names worked on the series. And the back issues are so expensive and they're not that well printed. The best way, really, is just to illegally download it. Because that's the way you're going to be able to read it. And it's, there you go, it's a fun read. Eventually, if they actually sort it all out, I will happily buy a copy.
Well, I mean, it just kind of begs two questions. A, why doesn't Todd just give up, for God's sake? What on earth's his problem? And B, why doesn't Neil Gaiman just publish and be damned and then see who tries to sue him,
Yeah, well, you need to be quite courageous to do the last piece. Also, it's not just to do with Todd. It's also a lot of legal people have looked at it and they can't quite work out who owns what. Mm. Anyway, I mean, I can't really see Todd's claim to it standing up, but there's all various different sorts. It turns out, I mean, initially the comic was published, the one we're talking about, in Warrior Magazine by Des Skin, in the belief that the original Marvel Man was now in public domain, the company had gone bankrupt, no one owns the company anymore, and it looks like that might not have actually happened. The company might have closed but not gone bankrupt, so it might have been owned by somebody else who just never came forward. And it's just thrown a legal span into the whole works. I can't see it being published in the near future. It's very good, though. Mm. It's very good indeed.
Well, even though the original Marvel Man was a rip-off of Captain Marvel,
and Captain Marvel was successfully sued by DC as a rip-off of Superman. So yeah, it all goes back to the source. So yes, it's. I remember DC at one point looked at publishing Marvel Man, and like they did with V for Vendetta, both in Warrior, and chose not to because of the legal situation. Back then, they didn't know what exactly was going on. So. And that's before Eclipse, before Tom McFarlane, before anybody else. So at one point I was quite hopeful of seeing it all resolved a few years ago, but the fact that it wasn't suddenly led me to realise there's an awful lot more complicated things going on there. I like the publishing to be damned. That would be my attitude, yeah. But then the odds are I would probably be damned somehow or other.
Well, he could just change the name of the character again, call him Messianic Man or something.
Messianic Man? but then who owns the actual previous issues? It's no good. No one's really interested in reading new stories of Marvel Man by Joe Bloggs. We want to read the Alan Moore, Neil Gaiman episodes. Those are the ones we want to read, thank you. So,
if Neil and Mark Buckingham brought out the Silver Age about... Messianic Man.
I like Messianic Man. That's quite good. But and then of course, who else has fallen out? Who else? Steve Bissett's fallen out with Alan Moore. Alan Davis has fallen out with Alan Moore. Everyone's fallen out with Dead Skin. I can't see it happening. Not everyone's fallen out with Dead Skin. A few people are. But this is my bread and butter. Mm. It's all these creative feuds kind of stuff. It's always wonderful to report on, and it gets so many hits. People love to see their favourite creator. Maybe it's a superhero thing. Everyone likes to see the Hulk versus the Thing, or Thor versus Galactus, whatever. And that, so you just extend it. We now all want to see John Byrne versus Rob Liefeld because it's just another clash of the titans. Because you demanded it, true believer. Kind of thing. Maybe that's the reason. I don't know, but I'll keep publishing it.
The current level of media interest in comics through the movies and then sort of retro documentaries like Comics Britannia, can you see a healthy British comic scene emerging again? Because at the moment, I mean, it does seem to be very much a niche interest.
Actually, I think there is. I mean, if you go to Doctor Who Adventures magazine, but you go to the newsstand, it's full of British comics and some reprints of American comics, but there's just like there were when I was a kid in the 80s, all the superhero stuff being reprinted. But there's always new stuff, and there's a lot of stuff there. Just talking to Kev Sutherland, who writes and draws for the Beano, he's just got Bash Street Kids zombie strip in an upcoming.
is everyone Beano. Doing zombies?
Yeah, now even the Beano. It's there's all sorts of comics still being done, and I think it's actually fairly healthy. You still have 2000 AD in the magazine. You still have Viz comic. And various imitators, and you, every now and then you see a new little thing pop up. It's still very much, there's a lot of stuff that's kids based, but then that always was the way. Mm. And you've got the superhero reprint stuff again. That was always the way. Just we haven't had anything like a Deadline for a while, and that'll be nice. I think now is about the time we deserve to have something like Deadline back again. That was a wonderful comics music magazine that had some fantastic strips, created things like Tank Girl and Wild World. And it had Cheeky Wee Budgie Boy, and then it had reprinted strips from Peter Bagg from America, and things like Evan Dawkins' Milk and Cheese. And that was a really strong thing. I mean, you see that now in things like Gorillaz, that is probably its natural successor, but in a very different form.
Artist.
Yeah, same artist, there's quite a few people, same people involved. I'd like to see something like Deadline back in, something like Escape, something like Revolver, something that's a bit more an adult British comic book that isn't. I like Viz, but isn't Viz something that's a bit more mature? I don't know, a bit more considered. I'd like to read that again, but of course all those creators are now doing exactly that for the American market. I mean, maybe it is the fact that it's all gone into trades now. What happens is now that the British creators create a comic book for American publisher, it gets published there, it gets licensed back to Titan Books in the UK, and it comes out on the bookshelves here. I mean, if you look at it in that way, the British comic scene is healthier than it's ever been before. If you look at all the work, all the Vertigo stuff on those bookshelves, it's just moved, and we've actually outsourced the initial publishing rights to America. Just as they'll outsource, say, like the colouring to India or whatever, we've just outsourced the initial publishing to America. It's still the British comics industry. It's just move the inefficient part to another continent. It's one way of looking at it. I quite like it actually. I've just come up with that right now. I think I might write about it. So thank you. I may end up in a future column.
My pleasure.
I suppose one last question might be, Brian Talbot's got his book about anecdotes from the comics industry from years gone by out. When can we expect yours?
Every Monday at Lying in the Gutters at comicbookresources.com. I mean, that it's full of that kind of stuff. And every time I get those great stories, I'll be putting them in. There's a couple from this weekend, which I was quite entertained by. Just probably to Tony Lee, who is... writer for Marcosia, who has been unconsciously dressing as Han Solo this entire week. He didn't actually realise the black jacket with a white shirt and stuff, and this little bum bag, a bit like a holster, and suddenly everyone's been going up to him and going, "Oh, Han Solo," kind of stuff, and he's been, "No, I'm not Han Solo." And I just love the fact that you can actually come to a comics convention, dress as Han Solo, and not realise it. And I like that. I might have to do something on that. But you always get these. Convention's always good for stories. And I've been mostly working here, but I expect when I get back to get all sorts of lovely emails with people telling me all the things that happen in the conventions, in the various hotel rooms and the bars, and I can put them together into a very fun column on Monday.
Excellent. Thanks a lot.
For more info and links about this episode, please visit www.panelborders.com and click on the link marked blog. Panel Borders will be back on air on the 15th of November at 5 p.m. on Resonance 104.4 FM and will feature my interview with Mike Mignola about his career and the many incarnations of Hellboy.